Okay, hi, good evening. Pleased to see you all again this evening. Okay, before moving on to chapter 3, a few points I wanted to finish up from the first two chapters, particularly chapter 2, but also to see chapter 2 in light of chapter 1. One point we didn't get around to discussing last time is, okay, you see on the screen, something called a leitvort. Leitvort, Hebrew called mila mancha, in proper English called a keyword. This is a leading word, a word that leads you through a literary unit. And if we look at chapter 2, we'll see the word ro'eh appearing several times. And what's interesting about a leitvort is that its meaning shifts as you move along. Sometimes it's the literal meaning, sometimes it's the way the word is used or the context in which it appears. So at the beginning of the chapter, the word ro'eh, to see, is used for the beacons, the people who are signaling that the new moon has been sanctified. They see one another. In other words, the one who's on one mountaintop keeps on waving it up and down until he sees that there's another beacon on the next mountaintop, and then he can stop, and that's the way the signal gets passed on. So seeing is used, interestingly, not within the framework only of seeing the moon, within the framework of how you transmit that information. Then in Mishnah Vav, you have the interrogation of the witnesses includes, how did you see the moon? Okay. How was it seen by you? Okay. And if he describes it correctly, then that's a sign he's probably, a true witness. Okay. Then again in Mishnah Zayin, when the moon was or was not seen at its appointed time, again, this is seeing by the witnesses. In Mishnah Chet, it's again the interrogation of the witnesses. Rabban Gamliel asks them, how did you see the moon? He would show them a picture and say, did it look like this? Did it look like that? And finally, in the stories that conclude chapter 2, remember there were two stories where there were very problematic witnesses. Both sets were accepted by Rabban Gamliel, and in both cases, there were rabbis who challenged him. And the second one led to the very dramatic encounter and conflict between Rabban Gamliel and Rabbi Yoshua. So the story opens with the witnesses describing how they saw it, and the way they describe seeing it makes no sense. There's something self-contradictory in the testimony. But then we come finally to another interesting wrinkle in the word ro'eh, when Rabbi Yoshua accepts Rabbi Dosa's rejection of the witnesses. Rabban Gamliel accepted them. Rabbi Dosa challenges him. He says, how can you possibly do that? This is similar to saying to say that the new moon was sighted the first night and was absent the next night, tantamount to saying that a woman gave birth and the next day you see she is very much pregnant. Can't be. And Rabbi Yoshua then answers, ro'eh ani et varecha, I see your words. It's like in English today, I see your point. And so interestingly, in the final appearance of this word in the chapter, to see has now become something intellectual. Okay, to see means I understand, I accept, I agree with. Okay, so now let's look at how the word seeing takes us through the different way stations on the road to sanctifying the month. Seeing starts with the witnesses. They see the moon. They come to the court. The court quizzes them, interrogates them. How did you see the moon? And based on their descriptions and the correspondence between the descriptions, they'll decide whether or not to accept the testimony. Then then the court deliberates. And when the court deliberates, you can have one of the rabbis on the court saying, Ro'eh ani et varecha. I see your argument. You think that the witnesses are true witnesses. Someone else thinks they're false. I see the point of this one or of that one. Okay, so the seeing has now morphed from the physical seeing of the witnesses to the intellectual seeing of the court. And then finally, that the court sends out the messenger, not the messenger, sends out the their delegates who then send out the beacons, and the beacons have to see one another. Okay, and finally, the final one who lights it on the top of a mountain called Beit Biltin will see the entire diaspora, meaning the Babylonian diaspora, lit up like a bonfire. Okay, so what we see then is the vision of the witnesses becomes then the intellectual determination of the court, which in turn translates back into something visual. The way the court transmits the information about sanctifying the new moon is visually. Now, we talked last time about how this visual way of sending it is probably the most efficient. It's certainly the fastest way of communicating it. But from the way the Mishnah describes it, okay, how you see this whole chain of bonfires stretching from Yerushalayim all the way into the diaspora, I think what we can see, okay, and the word see, now we're seeing this intellectually like the court, what we can see is it was very important for the court that the people find out about the new moon not only orally, not only by hearing about it, but by seeing it. It's as though they're participating in the experience. The experience of the witnesses through the mediation of the court's deliberations and decision now becomes an experience shared by all of Israel. And that experience, among other things, connects the high court in Jerusalem to the entire Jewish people. Not only the ones in the land of Israel, but even the ones in Bavel. Okay, even they participate in the experience. Okay, so this transforms the sanctification of the new moon into a public event, which everybody participates, and the sense through which they participate is visual. Okay, so that's one point that I thought was interesting and important to note, and it will be particularly important because, as we'll see in chapter 3, vision again plays a role, but now a new role that we did not see in chapter 2. But before getting to that, I want to make another couple of points about chapter 2 and the relation between chapter 2 and chapter 1. Another interesting thing that happens in chapter 2 is there are various word plays and associative connections. I have them listed here on what you have on the screen. I want to focus, okay, we had more time, we would look at them one by one. I just want to focus on the one that I think is most interesting, okay? This word association is created by two parts of the chapter that are surprising and arresting. Okay, so I'll remind you of some of the points we made last time. One of them is, okay, at the end of the chapter, that's on the left of your screen over here. Okay, when Rabbi Dosa, in rejecting the witnesses, says, for the witnesses to claim that the new moon was sighted one night and the following night did not appear, stand him out to saying, Al Haishashi Yalda, Lumachar Kresa Ben Shinah. Okay, the woman gave birth, and the next day her belly is completely extended. She is clearly very much pregnant even now. So clearly she did not give birth. Same thing with these witnesses. Okay. Now this comparison of the new moon, okay, to a woman giving birth is interesting. We maintain that in our language to this very day. Okay. The new moon is called in Hebrew, molad. Okay. You've ever heard in Shul, the molad is announced when they announce the new month. Okay. We do Birkat HaChodesh and the Gabbai will announce the molad. The molad literally means born, the newborn. It's the newborn moon. And when you have a long month, a 30-day month, instead of a 29-day month, so Rosh Chodesh is on the 31st day, so that month is called a Chodesh Me'ubar. Me'ubar. Me'ubar literally means pregnant. It's a pregnant month. Okay? It's pregnant because the molad hasn't appeared yet. The baby hasn't been born yet. So we continue to use this image in describing the transition from one month to another. Okay? Rabbi Dosa, you know, gives this a certain resonance. But I think the Mishnah indicates that there's something going on here. It's not just by accident. Because at an earlier point in the Mishnah, one of the Mishnayot we paid close attention to last week was the Mishnah that talks about how the witnesses, when they arrived in Yerushalayim after traveling on Shabbat, they were confined to the courtyard where they had arrived in order to give the testimony. They were not allowed to leave because they had gone outside of their Tchum Shabbat. And then Rabban Gamliel said, this is crazy. The witnesses won't come. So in order to motivate them to come, Rabban Gamliel decided to institute that they would be allowed to go 2,000 amot outside of this courtyard. They're allowed in any direction from where they are, 2,000 amot. They can't necessarily return home. They're allowed to travel freely within the city and even outside the city for 2,000 amot. Okay. Then the Mishnah surprisingly says, oh, and there are some other places where Rabban Gamliel instituted the same thing. And the Mishnah then lists several cases of pikuach nefesh, okay, of danger to life. And we noted last time that this seems to indicate that testifying about the new moon is tantamount to pikuach nefesh. And we've talked both weeks about how sanctifying the new moon is as significant to communal existence as saving a life is for the individual. Okay? But what's interesting in our connection is the first example the Mishnah brings. Af chachama haba'a liyaleid. Chachama, a wise woman. But who's the wise woman? She's coming to cause one to give birth, liyaleid. Okay? The wise woman is a midwife, what we call today a mialedet, but the Torah also calls a mialedet. In Chazal, in a few places, it's called chachama. A wise woman means a woman who is, okay, who is expert at helping to deliver babies. So for the midwife to go to help deliver a baby is one of the pikuach nefesh examples that the Mishnah brings. That yes, she can also travel freely after she has completed her mission. And now what I find usually interesting is how these two now interact. Because it's not only the word liyaleid that connects this Mishnah with Rabbi Dosa's sarcastic argument later on at the end of the chapter, it's also the word chachama. Because how does the confrontation between Rabban Gamliel and Rabbi Yoshua end? Rabbi Yoshua trudges wearily to Yavne on the day that he thought was supposed to be Yom Kippur. And Rabban Gamliel greets him happily, stands up, kisses him on his head and says, Bo v'shalom Rabbi v'talmidi, Rabbi v'chochma. Even though you are talmidi because you accepted my ruling, because ultimately the halacha rests on authority, and I am the authoritative figure, and you did the right thing by accepting my authority. When it comes to chokhmah, to wisdom, Rabban Gamliel acknowledges, you are my superior, you are my teacher when it comes to wisdom. Wisdom and authority don't always go hand in hand. We try to bring them into sync, but they don't always coordinate. And when they don't, then authority trumps wisdom. But at the same time, right, Rabban Gamliel does acknowledge, you are my master in wisdom. And I think this can verbal associative connection between Chachama Ba'al Yaldei and the story of Rabban Gamliel and Rabbi Yoshua is interesting, because what does it teach us? Rabbi Dosa wanted to argue, what sanctifies the new moon? The birth. When the new moon is born, that's when it's sanctified. And what in the end do we say at the end of the story? Okay? What really determines the new moon is not the birth, but the wisdom. It's the wisdom of the sages that determines the new moon, because after all, okay, it's very possible, even likely, that Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur that month were determined not by the moon, but by Rabban Gamliel and his court. They determined it. Had nothing to do with the moon. They could have been entirely wrong about the moon. The witnesses who testified about it, very questionable whether we can accept their testimony. But Rabbi Akiva said to his teacher, Rabbi Yoshua, but whatever Rabban Gamliel determined, that's it. That's the final word, because it is not the birth that determines the new moon, not the birth of the moon that determines the month. It is the wisdom of the sages. And if the wisdom of the sages decrees that the authoritative figure whose wisdom will be finally determinative is that of Rabban Gamliel, that's what will determine. Much as if a woman tries to give birth without a midwife, that's danger. That's a danger to life. Most women will not succeed in delivering safely without a midwife to help them through. And the new moon will not be safely delivered and declared to be a new month until the wisdom of the sages determines it to be the case. As I think this is a, you know, very interesting and instructive wordplay. And now one final point, which will sum up the first two chapters, then we'll move on to chapter 3. Okay, we noted already that chapter 1 concludes with the pasuk, Ele mo'ade Hashem asher tikru otam bimo'adam. Bimo'adam, meaning it is so crucially important to determine the month at its appointed time that we will even allow the witnesses to violate Shabbat in order to get it right. And then chapter 2, what's the same pasuk, Rabbi Akiva, speaking to Rabbi Yoshua, says, whatever Rabban Gamliel said is correct, and it doesn't matter whether he was right or not in accepting the witnesses, that's the halacha. And he proves it from the pasuk, Elim Ode Hashem Mikrei Kodesh, Asher Tikra'u Otam. He leaves out the word bimo'adam and replaces it with bein bizmanan, bein shelo bizmanan. You will declare them whether at the right time or not at the right time. Seems to be the exact opposite idea of bimo'adam. So there's a very daring drasha on the part of Rabbi Akiva. Interestingly, Rabbi Yoshua seems to accept this drasha. Okay? But by concluding the two chapters with these psukim, the Mishnah is really presenting us, I think, with a very serious challenge. The first chapter is all about how much we overextend ourselves, even to the point of Chilul Shabbat, in order for us to get it right. Astronomy will dictate, we have to get it right. So we will even violate Shabbat. and chapter 2? Well, all of chapter 2 is about the court. The court decides which witnesses to accept and which witnesses not to accept, and sometimes even arbitrarily. Sometimes it's for political reasons. There are witnesses who are trying to undermine the system. So the court says, we will accept only witnesses whose veracity can be guaranteed, which is not the halakha, but it's their institution. So they are deciding somewhat by fiat which witnesses to accept. By the end of the chapter, Rabban Gamliel is deciding to accept highly problematic witnesses, and that in the end determines the halakha. So if chapter 1 basically tells us that the moon is sanctified by the Leida, it's sanctified by what happens up in the sky, the new moon is sighted. That's what determines, and man has to simply ratify that, and that's why you even violate Shabbat, so that we can get it right. Chapter 2 is all about how it is ultimately man who sanctifies, and God will go along. And if man decides to sanctify the wrong day, God will go along with that too. So it's not just the two psukim that close the chapters that give you conflicting messages. It's really the entirety of chapter 1 and the entirety of chapter 2 that give you conflicting messages. Okay, now we had more time to discuss this. We would try to figure out how do we resolve that contradiction. But I think no less important than how you resolve the contradiction, in practice, we do resolve the contradiction. But what I think is no less crucial is that the Mishnah, by concluding these two chapters in this way, and by presenting two almost opposite conflicting pictures at the end of each chapter, I think what the Mishnah is really trying to do is to challenge us to confront the issue and to say to ourselves, well, who really determines? Is it really God who determines? Are we really responding to what is determined up there in the heavens? Or is it really man down here, the court that determines? And I think the Mishnah is summoning us to understand that there's no one answer to that question. They're both true. On one level, God determines. And God's agent for determining it is the heavenly bodies, and particularly the moon. That's what determines. That's how God tells us, sanctify the new month. And we'll violate Shabbat to do that, if need be. And then in chapter 2, God says, you sanctify the month. It is your responsibility. It is your authority. You will sanctify it, and I'll go along with you. How can both of those be true? Well, somehow they can both be true. But I think the point of the Mishnah is not as much to lead us to one way or another of resolving that contradiction as to point out to us that that contradiction is built into our halachic system. Our halachic system is grounded in both of these being true. Now, this, by the way, has a history, because among those sectarians who rejected the way in which the Chazal and the Mishnah ran the calendar, conducted the calendar, many of those sectarians believed very strongly that man has no authority. Man can only be a mouthpiece for the divine word. And even when man interprets the halakha, he's simply serving as a mouthpiece for the divine. It's really God who is interpreting the halakha through the agency of a certain human institution. And I think Chazal are very clearly indicating to us that's a very tempting way of looking at things. That way, we know that when we observe the halakha, we are doing God's will. But we have a more complicated, I'd say, dialectical way of looking at it, in which it could be that we are not getting God's messages exactly right, and it's still God's will that we that Am Yisrael observe the festivals and by extension the halacha in that way. Okay, so I think these two chapters really, I think, have some very powerful messages. Okay, again, if we had more time, we'd look at these a little more closely, but unfortunately, we don't really have time for that, and so. Okay, so let's move into chapter 3. Okay, we'll have to do a quick job of just surveying what the chapter has to say. I hope all of you took the opportunity to read through the chapter so you have, so what I'll be saying in the next few minutes will not be new to you. But if you're missing a point here or there, these points will be coming up again as we go through the class. Okay, so the chapter opens with Ra'uhu Beitin V'chol Yisrael. They saw it. What's it? The new moon. It's got to be referring to an antecedent. The only antecedents are the previous two chapters. So the way the chapter opens, we're expecting chapter 3 to be a direct continuation of chapters 1 and 2. We're still talking about Kiddush HaChodesh. And in Mishnah Aleph, indeed, we are. Okay? And we open with an impressive new law where it's not the witnesses who saw the new moon and came to the court to be interrogated, but it is the court itself that saw the new moon. Or, that's how I'm going to translate the Vav of the Chol Yisrael, okay, or all of Israel. If the court or all of Israel saw the new moon, or if Nechkeru Haidim, or if the witnesses were interrogated, and in any of these three cases, Lo Hispiku Lomar Mikudash, Ad Shechashecha, this was all towards the end of the day. And they saw the new moon and the court wanted immediately to declare Mikudash. This new month has been sanctified. And they didn't get the words out before it got dark. And when it's dark, it's too late. Courts are allowed to operate during the daytime, not at night. So an act that must be performed by a court has to be done during the daytime. And so they just didn't succeed in doing it. Harezeh mu'ubar. Okay, again, that word mu'ubar, by the way. Okay, it's pregnant. Okay, it's an extended month. Okay, so the next day will be the Rosh Chodesh and not today. They tried to get today to be Rosh Chodesh. Didn't happen. Didn't work. And then the Mishnah continues with other cases where it's only the members of the court who saw it without the rest of Israel, or only two members of the court saw it. In each case, the Mishnah details, okay, what the court can do. Okay, so the wrinkle here that we didn't have in the first two chapters is what happens if you don't go through the normal procedure of witnesses testifying before the court, but rather the court themselves just want to sanctify the new moon based on their own perception or even the perception of all of Israel. And now, surprisingly, the Mishnah sharply shifts back to the laws of Rosh Hashanah. I'll remind you that the first chapter opened with two Mishnayot about Rosh Hashanah, then shifted to Kiddush HaChodesh for two chapters. Then it ran into the first Mishnah of this chapter, and now we're back to Rosh Hashanah, and the whole rest of the show of this chapter will be about Rosh Hashanah, and particularly about one aspect of Rosh Hashanah, the main aspect, which is blowing the shofar. Okay? We should note, nowhere does it say that on Rosh Hashanah, in the Torah, that on Rosh Hashanah you blow a shofar. All the Torah says is that Rosh Hashanah is a day of Yom Truah, sounding blasts, or Zichron Truah, commemoration in or through blasts. Okay? We sound the blast of what? From the Torah, you wouldn't know. But Chazal understand that to be a shofar. What that's based on, assuming we get to that point this evening, we'll have a chance to note where that comes from, why they decide it's from a shofar. Okay, but in any event, that's the presupposition. And like the Mishnah does very frequently, it doesn't start off by saying, as most law codes would, if you want to see how most law codes would operate, it's usually instructive to compare Mishnah to the Rambam's Mishneh Torah. The Rambam will always start with something like, on the first day of Tishrei, known as Rosh Hashanah, okay, we are commanded to sound a shofar, we're supposed to sound the following blast, etc., etc. Okay? And then later on, he'll start getting into the details. But here, the Mishnah starts, as it very often does, in the middle of the topic. Okay? So the Mishnah is assuming we know that on Rosh Hashanah, we sound blasts of a shofar. And then it says, well, what is a shofar? So it starts off with all shofarot are kasher, except for the shofar of a cow, because it is not called a shofar, but rather a keren, okay, a horn rather than a trumpet. Rabbi Yosei says, yes, but all shofarot are called horns. But shofar and horns are simply synonymous words that are often used interchangeably. And he brings a proof text from the conquest of Jericho. The conquest of Jericho, remember, the people had to march around the city for 6 days. On the seventh day, which according to tradition was on Shabbat, they marched around the city 7 times, at the end of which they sounded shofarot, and then the walls came tumbling down. Right? And it says in the book of Yoshua, Bimshoch Bekeren Hayovel. Now we know from other psukim that they were sounding shofarot. And the shofarot came from a yovel, which is one of the biblical terms for a ram. It was a ram's horn, shofar. Okay? And it's also called here a keren. So if even something officially called a shofar, a ram's horn, can be called a keren, argues Rabbi Yosei, what's the problem with using the horn of a cow as well? So what if it's called a keren? That shouldn't disqualify it. In any event, we have this generic rule that all shofarot can be used for blowing on Rosh Hashanah. And now, interestingly and surprisingly, the next several Mishnayot tell us that certain special kinds of shofarot were used. So in Mishnah Gimel, we're told that the shofar of Rosh Hashanah, it was made from the straight horn of an ibex. That's, of course, not what we do. We use a ram's horn. We don't follow this Mishnah, okay? But how to interrelate this Mishnah with the previous Mishnah is a challenging matter, and commentators have very different ways of trying to reconcile them. Okay, the way that I think makes best sense and is supported best by the flow of the Mishnah is that the shofar described here is not the shofar that we're blowing any old place, but let's look at how it's described. Okay, it's a shofar. Its mouthpiece was plated with gold, and there were 2 trumpets on either side, the chatzotzrot. The shofar would sound a long blast, the trumpets would sound a short blast, because the mitzvah of the day is with the shofar. Where is this taking place? I think it's very clear. There's only one place where we can expect that you're going to have a gold-plated shofar, and that is going to be accompanied by blowing chatzotzrot. Chatzotzrot are normally blown where?
Beit HaMikdash.
That's right. They're blown in the Beit HaMikdash. And that's where we could also expect that you could have gold-plated shofar. And not every community can afford a gold-plated shofar. So this is the shofar of the Beit HaMikdash. I think that's one of the suggestions, and I think it's the best one. Mishnah Bet is talking about shofar being blown throughout Israel and in Chutz La'aretz, can be anything, with one or two exceptions. And in the Beit HaMikdash, the practice was always to blow a straight shofar. Straight means curved in only one direction. However, on fast days, why are we talking about fast days? Not clear. We are talking about shofarot. This Mishnah is quite similar to the previous Mishnah in terms of its form. The content is almost diametrically opposed. Okay? But the Mishnah is again digressing, which it often does. Apparently for associative reasons, but as we've seen in other cases, perhaps not only for associative reasons. So it's from a curved arms of rams, which means it's not curved only in one direction, but it hooks over. Okay, so it's as though it's bent over. Okay, that's what we do on Taniyot, and it's silver plated, and the Chatzot's rotor in the middle, the shofar rotor on the side, because the main mitzvah on the fast day is the Chatzot's rot. And then another digression. Jubilee. Now we know that on Jubilee year, we also blow the shofar on Yom Kippur, on the 10th day of Tishrei, Yom Kippur. That's when we sound the shofar and proclaim liberty throughout the land. Okay? And the Yovel is similar to Rosh Hashanah regarding the Tkiyah and the Brachot. And in context, Tkiyah here seems to mean not the blowing, but the instrument that you blow. In other words, you use the same shofar. Use the same shofar for Rosh Hashanah and for Yovel, which according to the previous Mishnah means the Ya'el Pashut. Okay, the ibex, which is curved only in one direction, goes straight up. However, Rabbi Yudah disagrees. Rosh Hashanah tokin v'shel zecharim. That's our practice. Okay, at least the chatchila, that on Rosh Hashanah we blow, okay, a ram's horn, which is curved, which is bent over. But on Yovel, yes, on Yovel we do use Ye'elim. Okay, so this was all a digression from Rosh Hashanah to show you what kind of shofar we blow on other special occasions. Okay, and what the Mishnah appears to be doing, I think, is to say, to really understand what the shofar on Rosh Hashanah means, what it means to blow the shofar on Rosh Hashanah, it's important to see it against the backdrop of other occasions when we have similar practices. And there are two other similar occasions. One of them is the Ovel. One of them is Ta'aniyot. Okay? And when we see what's similar and different between Rosh Hashanah and these other days, that will give us an idea of how to conceptualize the festival of Rosh Hashanah and its central mitzvah, which is blowing the shofar. If we have time, we'll come back to that point later. Okay, but now, up till now, what has been our topic? Topic has been the source of the shofar, which is correlated with its shape. Depending on the shape you want to have, you will take a shofar from this animal or from that animal, so it will have the shape that you want it to have. And now we move in Mishnah Vav to the physical integrity of the shofar. Okay, what happens if a shofar is cracked? What happens if a shofar is broken and we glue the pieces together? What happens if it has a hole in it that was sealed? Okay, so then the answer to the first two, when there's a crack along the shofar, or when the shofar breaks and you glue it back together, okay, there the Mishnah simply says pasul. That's no good, because that's not a real shofar. There's a shofar has to be natural. It can't be artificial. Okay, when you blew a shofar together, that's not a shofar. You can't use it. But if it just has a hole in it, and I seal the hole, so then it depends. That depends when I blow the shofar. Okay, will this hole affect the sound of the shofar or will it not? Big dispute among commentators. Are we talking about the hole affecting the shofar before it was glued or after, before it was filled in or after it was filled in? And what material can you use to fill it in? Okay, but we don't have time for those issues. But what is interesting and we will be coming back to is that in this case of the hole, so then the Mishnah doesn't say flat out it's kosher, it's not kosher. The Mishnah says it depends how it affects the sound. In the first two cases, it doesn't matter whether it affects the sound or not. Maybe it didn't affect the sound. Doesn't matter. The shofar lacks integrity. Here, the shofar has its physical integrity, but the sound has to have its integrity as well. It's not enough for the shofar to have its integrity. The sound has to be a full-fledged shofar sound as well. Now we move from, okay, we've moved from the source and shape of the shofar to the physical integrity of the shofar. Now we move to, if you blow the shofar into a pit or a cistern, so then if you hear the sound of the shofar, it's fine. If you hear the sound of the echo, it is not. So now it's not only the sound emanating from the shofar that has to be whole. It's the sound that you hear from the shofar that has to be original. You have to hear the original sound of the shofar. But if you hear an echo, that's no good. This, by the way, is a key source for contemporary halachic discussions of things like using a microphone in a shul. Forgetting the issues of electricity, whether it's okay or not okay, but there are also issues of, if you hear the shofar through a microphone, are you hearing the shofar or are you hearing something that halachically is considered like an echo? Okay? And similarly, says the Mishnah, someone who is passing behind a Beit Knesset and he hears the sound of a shofar, so he's in the middle of something else. He's not in shul. He's not coming to hear the shofar. He's passing by. And all of a sudden, he hears the shofar. Im kivein libo yatsa. Imav lo yatsa. If he directs his heart, that's the literal translation of kivein libo. If he directs his heart, then he fulfills the mitzvah. If he does not direct his heart, then he does not. Okay, so the Mishnah tells us it's not enough to physically hear the shofar. You have to consciously hear the shofar, intentionally hear the shofar. You have to be aware that you're listening to a shofar. You have to be aware of the context and say, yes, that's what I want to do. If you hear the shofar and you say, oh, nice music, almost as good as Louis Armstrong, then you're not fulfilling the mitzvah. But if you hear the shofar and say, right, it's Rosh Hashanah today, that's a shofar, let me listen to it, then, okay, then you're fulfilling the mitzvah. Okay, and then the chapter concludes with Agadah, with an Agadic section. And again, this is somewhat challenging. What is this Agadic section doing here? Okay, when Moshe raised his hands, then the Israelites would be successful, when he lowered them, then they would be defeated. That is a description of the battle against Amalek. And the Mishnah asks quite cogently, what are Moshe's hands doing here? Why does success in battle depend on Moshe's raised hands or lowered hands? And the Mishnah's answer is, when they saw Moshe's hands being raised, that's a bit of a jump, but the Mishnah makes that jump. When they see his hands being raised, and that in turn directs their hearts to their Father in heaven, Now, the text you have before you on your screen is Mishaabdin. But in manuscript versions of the text, you have Umichavnim. And that's crucially important. We'll see why in a couple of minutes. Okay, but they subjugate their hearts to their Father in heaven, then they would be successful. Similar story about the serpent. Okay, the first story, by the way, is the beginning of Israel's sojourn in the wilderness. The last story is at the end of their sojourn in the wilderness. And similarly, the brass serpent that was put on, you know, that was hung up on a tall pole, that saved people with the same religious dynamic. It would direct their hearts heavenwards and then they would be saved. And finally, the Mishnah concludes with, if people who are considered to lack understanding, okay, a deaf mute in those days, deaf mutes could not be educated, so they were considered not to have adult understanding, okay, an imbecile or a minor cannot blow on behalf of the community. Because anyone who is not himself or herself obligated cannot fulfill the obligation on behalf of the community. Okay, now let's start off by raising some questions. As we went along, we raised a couple of questions about the order of the Mishnayot, but let's add another couple of questions. Okay, this last Agadic Mishnah, what's it doing here? It's not about Shofar. It's not about Rosh Hashanah. Why is it here? What is the point of this Mishnah here? Okay, question number one. Question number two. Okay, after the Agadic, and normally, where does the Mishnah put a dramatic Agadah? We had an example of this at the end of chapter two. You put it at the end of a chapter. And this Agadic ending about how we have to subjugate our hearts to our Father in heaven, that would seem to be a very beautiful chapter ending. And to talk about, well, who is authorized to blow a shofar on behalf of the community seems to be a kind of anti-climax in the chapter. Why are we ending the chapter with that? And if anything, where would we expect this to be? This Mishnah about who can blow a shofar, where would we expect to find it? Well, let's go back again and take a look at the order of the Mishnayot in the chapter. Here, let's take a look here. Here we have here we have a diagram of the chapter. So let's take a look, starting with Mishnah Bet, right? Mishnah Aleph is an outlier, still about Kiddush HaChodesh. Mishnah Bet starts talking about the source and shape of the shofar. That runs through Mishnah Bet, Gimel, Daled, and Hey. Okay? Half the chapter is devoted to the source and shape of the shofar. The next thing is the physical wholeness of the shofar. Okay? Which then, at the end of the Mishnah, includes the wholeness of the sound of the shofar. Then we move to the blowing of the shofar, and we say you have to hear the shofar directly, hearing the whole sound. And then finally, you have to direct the heart. So we've talked about the nature of the shofar, the sound emanating from the shofar, okay, the wholeness of the sound, the hearing of the shofar, and the intention of the person who hears the shofar. What's missing from this description?
The blowing of the shofar, but the person
right. Who's supposed to blow it? How is he supposed to blow it? What sounds is he supposed to get out of the shofar? The act of blowing is absent. And what the Mishnah actually does is it fills in the who can blow at the very end of the chapter as this kind of appendix to the chapter. It's not really an integral part of the chapter. We ended the chapter with the Agadic Mishnah, and then we have a kind of appendix. Oh, who can blow the shofar? And then at the end of the next chapter, Perek Dalid, as we'll see next week, that's where the Mishnah finally gets to what sounds is he supposed to blow in the shofar. So there are two major parts of blowing the shofar that are left out of the main body of this chapter, Bet through Zayin. Okay? Now, part of the reason for that, I think, is clear in the diagram that I have here. We have the source and shape of the shofar. Then we have the wholeness leading into the wholeness of the sound. The wholeness of the shofar leads into the wholeness of the sound. The wholeness of the sound in turn leads into the hearing of a whole sound. And the hearing of the shofar then leads into the directing of the heart. Now, this is not just a logical progression, but I think you can detect here as well, I would call it a geographic progression. We're moving from the source of the shofar, the animal from which the shofar is taken. And maybe part of the point of the Mishnah is that animal is part of the process. When I blow the shofar, I'm not only thinking about the shape of the horn that I'm blowing, I'm also thinking about what animal did I take it from. That animal is maybe part of the message of the shofar. So I go from the animal to the shofar and its shape and its wholeness. That shofar then emits a sound. It has to be a whole sound as it emerges from the shofar, and not a shofar that emerges from a crack that affects the sound. And then the one who hears the shofar, right, the sound travels, someone hears it, and he has to hear that shofar directly. So it's a direct line of transmission. Animal, shofar, sound. The sound then goes to the ear and is heard. And then where does the sound go?
To the heart.
Goes to the heart. Now, what does the heart have to do, according to Mishnah Zayin? It simply has to be aware that what I'm blowing is a shofar. It's Rosh Hashanah. You have to be aware. Perhaps you have to intend, yes, this is a mitzvah. I want to fulfill that mitzvah. That's a discussion in the Talmud. What exactly is the content of the intention of the heart? Okay, but certainly the heart is sort of participating in this hearing of the shofar. Okay, I'm not just hearing it. I'm not only hearing it with my ear, I'm hearing it with my heart. Okay, if that reminds you of, I'm not only seeing the new moon with the eyes of the witnesses, but I am experiencing the new moon through the agency of the court, of the court's wisdom. I think in a way there's a kind of parallel between those two, and I don't think that's accidental. Okay? But be that as it may, let's now, okay, there are three Mishnayot whose placement in this chapter is very puzzling. One of them we just noted before, and that's about the Cheresh Shoteh V'Katan, why that's at the end. It's almost as though the Mishnah wants us to receive the sound of the shofar unmediated. We don't have a person blowing the shofar. It's just blown. You have to hear the shofar. The one who's blowing the shofar, that's incidental. Maybe that's not so important. Maybe that's part of the point. Okay? That's a possibility. We'll, you know, put that on hold for a while. Okay? But that's one question. Question number two, this Agadic Mishnah about the hands of Moshe and the brass serpent. And let's not forget the first Mishnah about Kiddush HaChodesh. Extremely puzzling. Why is this one Mishnah of Kiddush HaChodesh not somehow attached to the first two chapters? Why is it pushed off until our chapter. So let's start off with the main body of Mishnah Chet, the Agadic Mishnah. Okay? And here, the text I brought you here on this page is from the Kaufman manuscript, widely regarded as the best whole manuscript of the Mishnah. And you can see it says in Mishnah Chet, Umechavnim, Yisman, Shri Yisrael Mistaklim Klapei Lamala, Umechavnim et Libam Lavihem Shevashamayim. And that already gives us a cue. Why is this Mishnah here? Because Umechavnim et Libam links this Mishnah up with
Im kiven libo
yatsa, right? And now umechavnim et libam davihem shabashamayim, right? The same usage, okay? Kavanat halev. But now notice the difference between the two usages of kiven libo. In Mishnah Zayin, kiven libo, as I said, is just to intend to do the mitzvah performance. The mitzvah performance is to hear a shofar. I have to intend that. If I think I hear a donkey braying, or I think I hear Louis Armstrong trumpeting, I'm not doing any mitzvah. The only way I'm doing the mitzvah is if I intend the mitzvah performance, which is to hear a shofar. That's all it meant in Mishnah Zayin. That's the halachic meaning of kavanat halev, of directing the heart. In Mishnah Chet, directing the heart takes on a new meaning. To what am I directing the heart here?
Trusting Hashem.
Hashem.
Trusting Hashem
with everything. Why is that? Why does the Mishnah bring that at the conclusion of blowing the shofar? I think the Mishnah is clearly hinting to us that when I direct my heart, when I hear the shofar, and as a result of hearing the shofar, I say, oh, and I direct my heart to, let's listen. I want to hear that blowing of the shofar today on Rosh Hashanah, which is a mitzvah. That's not the whole story. What's the continuation of that story, says the Mishnah? The continuation is
the limb.
When I hear that, I direct the heart in a second sense as well. When I hear the shofar, it should direct my heart towards God. That's the purpose of blowing the shofar. The purpose of blowing the shofar is to direct my heart heavenward, to direct my heart towards God. I'm not just hearing the shofar because the Torah said so. I'm hearing the shofar because it's a meaningful experience. What's its meaning? Well, the same way that when Moshe raised his hands, what made that experience meaningful and therefore life-saving for Am Yisrael? And by the way, shofar, like Kiddush HaChodesh, is equated here to saving lives. Jewish lives are saved by directing your heart towards your Father in heaven, right? And the shofar is supposed to accomplish that. The same way Moshe's hands accomplished that, the same way the brass serpent accomplished that, the blowing of the shofar should accomplish the same thing. That's agadic. Agadic means, by definition, this is not a halachic requirement. If I heard the shofar and directed my heart to the mitzvah, and didn't think about my Father in heaven, didn't say, oh, the shofar is connecting me to my Father in heaven, I still fulfilled the mitzvah. I don't have to go ahead and perform the mitzvah again. But I am missing the soul of the mitzvah. The Agadah gives you the inner meaning of the mitzvah, the soul of the mitzvah, the purpose which I should have for the mitzvah. If I don't have it, it will not undermine the mitzvah fulfillment, but it will denuded of meaning. I won't accomplish what this mitzvah is designed to accomplish. And the Mishnah makes it very clear what this mitzvah is designed to accomplish. It's designed to direct my heart upwards towards heaven. That's what the shofar is about. And if we look back at many of the halachot in this chapter, I think we'll see how they're governed by that. The shape of the shofar, whether it's straight or curved, has everything in the world to do with the shofar's purpose to direct my heart towards God. I can stand before God in different postures. I can stand before God in a posture of standing up straight or bent over. In our prayers, we adopt these different postures at different times. So the shofar, is that a posture before God of being straight or being bent over? The fact that the shofar, as we deduce from the Mishnah, should be blown in the temple. But the point of the shofar is to connect us to our Father in heaven, to direct our hearts towards our Father in heaven, makes perfect sense that the main shofar blowing in Israel will be in the temple. Okay, so once we've seen that point, we see this Agadic Mishnah reflects not only on Kavanat HaLev, but it reflects on many of the other details in the chapter as well. And one final point, which we'll telegraph now and develop more fully Bezrat Hashem next class. Okay, does this give us any insight into why the first Mishnah of the chapter is here? Okay, so look at the color coding. Okay, Ra'uhu Beitin V'chol Yisrael and Shayu Yisrael Mistaklim Klapei Lamala. Here are two Mishnayot that are tacked on at the beginning and end of our chapter. They're not an integral part of the chapter. The main body of the chapter is Bet through Zayin. But the Mishnah tacked on at the beginning and the Mishnah tacked on at the end both have the same image of Israel looking up at the heavens. Israel looking up at the heavens. At the beginning of the chapter, when Israel looks up at the heavens, they see the new moon. And that will enable them to sanctify the new month. This, by the way, as we said, is different from what we had in chapter 2, where it's the witnesses who saw and just conveyed the information to the court. Here, all of Israel is looking up and seeing the new moon and enabling them to immediately sanctify the new moon if they get in the appropriate word, mikudash, before it gets dark. The end of the chapter, Israel looking up towards the heaven, they don't see anything concrete when they look in the heaven. What they see is that they're directing their hearts towards God. Now, could the Mishnah be indicating that the reason why we sanctify the new moon, the new month, by sighting of the new moon is in order to direct the heart of Israel towards their Father in heaven? Okay, our time is up. Okay, it's like the first Mishnah, it's Chashecha. We didn't get the word Mikudash out in time, and so we will leave the answer to that question hanging until next week, okay? But I think it's important to end with that question, and you'll have a week to reflect on it, and we'll see you next week what you all think. Erev Tov.
Thank you. I'd like to make a suggestion from what you said.
Yes.
Shofar is the same letters as Parash, the interpretation. The Kavanah is the Perush, the direction. Mm-hmm. The direction that we make is giving the correct Perush.
Okay, very good. That's an interesting thought.
Rav Avi, I have another question, perhaps for next week. If you built up this case that determining Rosh Chodesh is like Pikuach Nefesh and is Doche Shabbos, why is shofar blowing? What happened to it that it is that Shabbos pushes away shofar blowing for us now?
Okay. Excellent question. So coming attractions. That's a question that will be relevant in the first Mishnah of the next chapter, which will discuss exactly that. Can the shofar be blown on Shabbat? And the answer, which may surprise many of you is, well, sometimes yes. Okay, so so we'll see that Bezrat Hashem next time.
Yeah, can I ask one thing? Your last point, which I know you develop more next week, but you emphasized at the beginning the key word element. Now you have Kol Yisrael maybe, but you know there is a difference between Ra'u and Mistaklin. Is that in other words, how far can one go with that?
Okay, that's an excellent question. The short answer is that it's a judgment call.
Okay.
Okay. There's no hard and fast answer to that. In other words, obviously, when you're using the exact same word, and particularly when you're using it in different contexts and in different ways and even with different meanings, then you've got a stronger case for there being a word association. And as you remove one or another of those elements, so then your case is somewhat more tenuous. But depending on various factors, you can compensate. So here, for example, the fact that these are both, these Mishnayot frame the chapter. They both don't seem to belong organically to the chapter. Okay, I think that fortifies it. And I have other intertextual arguments to strengthen that, which Bezrat Hashem will touch on at the beginning of next week.
Thank you.
Rabbi, another question. It turns out that you have a very nice presentation of the page. The way it's showing on my screen is I'm showing a I'm showing one page with nice splashes of color, exactly that. But it's much too tiny to be able to read any of it.
Yeah.
Is there a way of making it bigger?
On Zoom, the only way I could do it is to divide up the page. So it's a question of either sacrificing legibility for the sake of having the whole chapter on one page, or enhancing legibility and breaking it up into two pages.
Maybe
next time I'll do both, and that way we can hopefully move back and forth so we can get some of the benefits.
Because when you're talking about the green splashes, that's all I need to be able to read. I don't need to be able to read the red and the yellow splashes.
Right.
You can do it yourself on your own screen under view options. You can blow it up for yourself.
Because it's his screen that's being shared. I have no control over his share.
Right. But I do send out the sheets in advance so you can, so you can put it on your own screen and play with it as you will. On your own personal copy. Yeah. But I'll see if I can improve that. I have to admit that neither graphics nor computer skills are my most fully developed skills. But
we share all of that, Rabbi. We share all.
Yeah,
that.
No, it does expand on my iPad with no problem.
Isn't that nice?
Yeah, right. I'm lucky. So,
It doesn't solve my problem, does it?
The file is always put on the web page for the class, so you can find it there. Or toward the beginning of class, I usually send a link to it in the chat, and that way you can have it open on your own screen, and then you can adjust and see whichever parts you need. It may be that you join the class after I sent the link, in which case I'll, in the future, I'll send it a few times during the class so that it's there for people who join.
That may do. We'll look forward. We'll give it a try next week.
Okay.
Thank you. Have a good week, everyone.
You too. And just a reminder to the people who are still here that Dr. Mark Shapiro's class on the Reform movement, the first generation of the Reform movement, and rabbinic attitudes toward that is starting up again tonight at 8:30 Eastern. Hoping to see you there or here again next week.
Maxine, I missed the last week's class of this class. Is the source sheet also on the website?
Yes.
Oh, so I can get it there. Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Okay, thank you all, everyone. Erev Tov.
Erev Tov.